Oil prices, a cashless China, and a new way to look at personal finance. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, December 28th. Good to have you with us. As we finish out the year, oil prices are up. The price of crude oil is flirting with a two-year high. So we've asked Marketplace's Scott Tong to join us to explain what's going on. Thanks for being with us.
Of course, Adrienne. How are you?
I'm well. So the price of oil went up in 2017 from 50-something dollars a barrel to 60-something. Was that something market watchers were betting on?
Well, funny you should ask about betting, Adrienne, because today I spoke with a bunch of oil geeks, analysts, academics, journalists, who like to bet on the year-end price of what oil is.
So are they betting money?
Some of them are nonspecific, exactly what's up for what's at stake here. It tends to be a number of beers, but this is what they do for fun. And one person really close to the lead as of today is Jason Bordoff at Columbia University. Now, today's price is $66 and change for what's called the Brent price. And he bet $69. And he assumed this past year correctly that global oil demand, despite all the talk of non-oil cars, of these electric cars, that world demand would stay strong. Here he is.
You see people using more oil, and we've seen that very strong demand growth in 2017. The second factor was a real commitment from the Saudis especially to push up the oil price and maintain a commitment to a supply agreement among OPEC countries.
And this is what he's talking about, Adrienne, that Saudi Arabia and other OPEC countries and Russia all promised that they would control supply and to keep prices up. And that also happened in 2017.
Huh.
I should say that last-minute global shocks like a pipeline going out or something happening in a place like Nigeria could still push prices higher, which is why author and journalist Steve Levine still hopes and thinks that he's going to win. He bet $69.99.
This year, I thought that the price would go up, and so that's why I went $69.99. I still have 3 days. We could have something happen.
Now, what about the role of U.S. oil from fracking? I mean, I have to imagine that's tempered the price here some.
That's right. U.S. production has surged this year. A lot of analysts weren't so sure that was going to happen. We've been coming out of a low-price environment, and a lot of companies went out of business. But U.S. production happened to be very resilient. West Texas just sent a record for production, and that really helped to keep a lid on prices not going too high this year.
Before I let you go, I want to ask about natural gas. Looking ahead to 2018, the U.S. is a big producer of natural gas. What's that mean for its use here and abroad?
Yes, we produce a lot of natural gas from this fracking technology. It's become very cheap, much cheaper than coal in a lot of places. So domestically, gas has pushed out coal in the electricity market. And now the U.S. is really starting to export some of our natural gas. It's expensive, but now we have more of the pipelines and the export facilities to do it. And now there's a lot of projections, a lot of optimistic projections that the U.S. could be a real natural gas export player in the next decade or so.
So, Scott, do you participate in these bets? Are you a crude oil geek who will place your bet on next year's price?
Geek, yes. And whether I place a bet, I think I have till the 31st to place mine, which I probably will.
Marketplace's Scott Tong. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Adrienne.
Markets today were feeling a little punchy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are in the world a lot of personal finance books, books that'll help you decide between a Roth and traditional IRA, books that promise the steps to a rich and fabulous life, books that'll help you take advantage of the tax code, aka books that need to be rewritten. The new book, The Financial Diet by Chelsea Fagan, is none of those things. It bills itself as a total beginner's guide to getting good with money and has chapters about budget and investing, but also about food, home, and love. Chelsea, thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In your book, on your other platforms, it seems like you're broadly focused. When you talk about the financial diet, it seems broadly focused on the millennial transition to grown-uphood. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that's fair.
Why is that where you've decided to focus the blog and the YouTube channel and the book on the sort of these big transitional questions?
Because I think money by itself is not that interesting, at least not to most people. So if we can frame it in the context of life more generally and lifestyle, I think it's a lot more appealing to a broader audience.
As I read your book, I was struck by that, how much of this advice isn't traditional money advice. How have sort of traditionalists responded to that? Is there some sense of like, hey, this isn't a personal finance book, this is something else?
Oh, I can 100% confirm that the actual personal finance / money community hate us.
Really? Tell me why.
A lot of them are what I would describe as sort of free market purists, and we speak very openly about progressive politics and how the solutions to a lot of these money issues are much more in the collective, things like student debt, predatory lending, that kind of thing. There's a real sense of gatekeeping. The financial world is not like medicine or law, where there are pretty strict regulations around who can talk about it. So the financial world and personal finance world tend to want to really gatekeep their own community and make it so that only, quote unquote, financial experts can talk about money, even in an editorial way. And we are not financial experts and don't aspire to be. So I think that they have this real sense of they should not be able to talk about this and they should not be successful.
So as you're dealing with that pushback, I mean, how do you deal with that pushback?
I ignore it entirely.
And how do you sell people on this idea that, no, when we're talking about money, we should be talking about what we eat and how we date, that we should be taking a broad-based look at our whole lives when we're talking about the financial diet?
I mean, I think that's just the core of what we do, and that has been what I think has made us popular, because the vast majority of people are not going to independently click on an article about 401ks, but if you can frame it in a way that has relevance to their overall life, I think they're much, much more likely to be interested.
Why do you think young people broadly, and women in particular, aren't getting this sort of advice either from schools, from their family? Where has this fallen down?
Whether or not you get a financial education and the degree to which you get it is going to be largely dependent on your family's financial literacy. I think there's also a lot of parents who don't put that on the checklist of things to teach their children about. Schools, I think, to be quite honest, I think the public education system and to an extent the private, although I'm not as familiar, don't do a great job about teaching a lot of things. There's not a huge incentive for it. I mean, unless you make it, you know, part of standardized testing and part of the regular curriculum, it's very hard to kind of inject these things into the high school education. I mean, you used to have things like home economics where you would have, you know, sort of like the family's pretend budget sheet for a week. But I don't think that was ever really, even for those people who had it, part of the core curriculum.
And is there, I mean, as somebody now who's the face of the financial diet, who does videos, who's got this new book out, do you feel a pressure to make the right choice all the time? Like, do you ever just say, you know what, I'm going to do something I know doesn't make any sense, that I know is against every piece of advice I give people every day, because it's hard to always live by the rules?
You know what? No, I think partially for opportunistic reasons. I think our brand is very much set up to be accommodating to being human beings. You know, our ethos has always been, you know, we're not robots. There are a lot of personal finance gurus and experts out there who advocate living these like extremely ascetic lifestyles and really counting every single penny. And I don't live that way. Our team doesn't live that way. We've never advocated living that way. So even if, for example, I bought a lot of decorations for the holiday season, which in some sort of objective sense, I guess, could be considered frivolous or wasteful, but they bring me a lot of joy. So I have zero regrets, and I don't feel particularly ashamed to say that.
Chelsea Fagan is the author of the new book, The Financial Diet. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Going cashless. Millions of people in the world's second largest economy are paying for their purchases with mobile phone apps like Alipay and WeChat. We're talking trillions of dollars in mobile payments each year. According to the Financial Times, China's central bank is tightening rules on those mobile payments and perhaps slowing the growth of the apps. But as the BBC's Ed Butler reports from the city of Hangzhou in eastern China, the payment systems are already pretty well ingrained in the economy.
I'm now just in one little street stall. This is in Hangzhou, south of Shanghai, and even in this shop, this is just like a hole in the wall where they sell soft drinks and crisps and snacks and other things. You can spend money using a digital platform. This is how young people spend all of their money right now, I'm told. I'm with one of them, Cindy. Hello, Cindy.
Hi.
Do you ever carry cash around with you anymore?
Nope. I usually pay by the Alipay.
Alipay. This is a platform on your phone. And there it is. That's the sound of the money being credited to the shopkeeper's account. Let's go and discover something even more technologically advanced. This is K-Pro, a version of KFC, for those familiar with that international chicken retailer. This is not just online payments. This is facial recognition payment. So we are going to step forward now and buy some food using Cindy's face.
Yeah.
We've stepped up to this screen. It looks like a large smartphone. Do you know what you want to buy?
Yeah, I want to buy a salad.
And this is the facial recognition part. She looks up at the camera and it ticks. It's literally your face is your code.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think it's quite funny.
You like it?
Yeah.
Let's be honest, Cindy, you could have done that just as quickly using your mobile phone, right?
Yeah.
So it's just a gimmick?
I don't think so. I think it's the future. I think the young people would like to use the face to order food or do anything else.
Hangzhou student Cindy. Well, it's no coincidence that we are in this city. It's home to Alibaba, which is the firm behind the Alipay system, the one that Cindy was just using there. Here in the city, I've been talking to Ronnie Wong, the general manager of one of its biggest shopping malls, the Kerry Centre. He says cashlessness is taking off here.
You can now come into any centres in Hangzhou without carrying cash, and everything is done on the phone.
Alibaba's greatest competitor is another Chinese company, Tencent, the creator of the mega app called WeChat. To get a sense of just how important WeChat has now become to the lives of millions of Chinese smartphone users, I spoke to a fellow Brit, Matt Brennan. He lives in China and he runs a consultancy here devoted entirely to exploiting WeChat's commercial potential.
WeChat started off, you know, 2011, and it pretty much was a messaging app, and it still is at its core, but it's expanded out beyond that. It's gone into payments. You can buy anything, do anything you want, hail a taxi, pay your utility bills, buy a cinema ticket, book a doctor's appointment. Anything you can do on the open web, you can do in WeChat.
It is extraordinary because we've talked in other parts of the world, haven't we, about the vision of a cashless society, but China has somehow leapfrogged everybody.
Definitely. These guys are both subsidizing this, I believe, because they're just going to take the market and get the payment habit down. And actually, they've succeeded because I know myself, like, if I want to pay, I instinctively take out my phone. Data that these guys are getting from, you know, all these transactions is coming straight to them. They're not actually right now sharing that data with anyone. Data's the new oil, right? So that alone is incredibly valuable.
That has huge potential for exploitation, for commercial exploitation, and perhaps, some would argue, for misuse.
Yeah, for sure.
And are you worried by that? I mean, people will say this, particularly about China, that this is another form of spyware, almost, kind of institutional control, potentially, over people.
I think it can be used in that way. I think the government here probably will use it in that way. Everyone accepts it as the reality of China.
That report from the BBC's Ed Butler in Hangzhou. Coming up?
The best way to look at the output is to sort of capture each pixel and turn it into a number. Digitize it.
The earliest days of the digital camera. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 63 points, a 0.25%, to finish at 24,837. The Nasdaq gained 10 points, a 0.1%, to close at 6950. And the S&P 500 was up 4 points, a 0.1%, to end at 2687. Several energy companies perked up on the back of those rising oil prices Scott mentioned. Range Resources piped up 3.8%. Chesapeake Energy rallied 4.1%. Food and drink firms swallowed some losses today. General Mills ground down 1%. Coca-Cola flattened 0.4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
December 31st is coming up fast, and that means time is running out to make your tax-deductible donation to support Marketplace. We're all about making people smarter about the financial forces that govern our lives and raising economic intelligence in a big way. It's important work that we are already doing, and with your help, we'll be able to do even more of it. So now is the time. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift in any amount to become a Marketplace investor today. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdal. Dangerous outbreaks of infectious diseases like Ebola and avian flu have tripled around the world since 1980. That's meant more work for the handful of labs in the U.S. that research pathogens and more opportunity to come up with life-saving, revenue-generating treatments. That has some labs thinking of expanding. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports.
Robert Davey is zipping up a suit his scientists wear when researching deadly pathogens.
Pull it down like that.
Davey directs the biosafety level 4 lab at the Texas Biomedical Research Institute in San Antonio. We're surrounded by suits hanging on racks on either side of us as he inflates this one like a balloon.
When you're getting ready to go in, you would then connect this hose, which is the airline, to the valve.
Just a few feet away, through a door that looks like it should be in a submarine, researchers develop vaccines and other countermeasures for viruses like Ebola and Marburg.
Yeah, the lab pressures are all normal. That's fine.
There are a series of airlocks to get into it, and each is pressurized in a certain way to stop the bad bugs getting out.
Texas Biomedical Research Institute is an independent, nonprofit research organization. On the 200-acre property, scientists research everything from cardiovascular disease and obesity to AIDS and infectious diseases. But 40% of the institute's revenue comes from this 1,200-square-foot lab. And the lab is maxed out.
Right now, it's 24/7.
Gene Patterson is a virologist at the institute and says it's ready for a new and bigger lab.
At this point in time, we are booked solid for 2.5 years, which means that we can't accept any new projects. And we've been that way for a couple of years now.
The Level 4 lab makes $16 million a year in revenue. And because the lab is so busy, in 4 years, the organization has turned away $40 million worth of work. It isn't clear how many of these Level 4 labs are in the United States because many don't advertise the work they do. The best estimate is under 10.
Well, it's absolutely critical.
Larry Zeitlin is president of MAP Pharmaceutical. It currently holds a license for a promising anti-Ebola therapy. And he says without enough labs, getting the right therapy, or in lab speak, the proper antibody candidate to market, becomes impossible.
We can't show that a candidate works. We can't satisfy the FDA that the candidate is appropriate for development.
Zeitlin often partners with Galveston National Laboratory, also in Texas. Its Level 4 lab is more than 10 times the size of Texas Biomed's, and research is still booked 12 to 18 months out. Despite securing $121 million in contracts last year, Galveston National Laboratory Director Jim LeDuc says any lab should be cautious about expanding.
Simply because these labs are extremely complex, they're extremely costly to run and operate, and you need to make sure that there's sufficient demand today and a decade from now to keep them busy.
Galveston estimates it spends $1 million a year just on utilities for its Level 4 lab. But Gene Patterson says Texas Biomed has done the research and its lab expansion makes financial sense.
I mean, it's not just that we're not making as much money. It's that we're not being able to provide the vaccine and treatments that are necessary to stop these outbreaks.
Texas Biomedical Research Institute is deciding how big to make its new lab, but Patterson is confident once it's built, the lab will still be very busy. In San Antonio, I'm Paul Flav for Marketplace.
Smartphones. phones and digital cameras have made us all photographers, pretty good photographers. It's way easier to come up with a picture I like when I'm not worried about how much film I've got left. There was a time back in the 70s when the idea of a digital camera was simply that, an idea with the potential to upend an entire industry. Here's the latest installment in our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
My name is Steve Sasson, and I worked for Eastman Kodak Company for over 35 years. I began in July of 1973. I was a junior engineer. My supervisor said, "We've got a filler job for you. There's a new type of imaging device called a charge-coupled device imager. We want somebody to look at one of these and see if we can do anything useful with it." Our conversation probably lasted about 30 seconds, maybe. You know, it was nothing. The device itself is a small piece of silicon that you expose with light, and whatever sort of image or light pattern is imaged on that surface creates a corresponding charge pattern. Figured, well, if I'm going to measure how this thing does something, I sort of have to look at the output, and the best way to look at the output is to sort of capture each pixel and turn it into a number, digitize it. So then I started thinking, well, okay, really what I'm doing is capturing an image. So I was building a camera. Most of the parts I used to build it were I stole from around the factory. I couldn't go out and buy anything, you know. Digital voltmeter chips, digital tape cassette prototype box. So it looks like an Erector set with a blue box on top of it with a lens stuck on the bottom. And I would output to a television set. And we took our first full images in December of 1975. I folded the camera up and I walked down the hallway and there was a young lab technician sitting at a teletype. Her name was Joy. So I asked her, I said, "Could I take a snapshot of you?" She said, "Sure, you know, whatever." The tape started to move, so that's how I knew I captured a picture. I popped it out of the tape player, put it into the playback system. It was quite a moment. Could this crazy thing actually work? Up popped the image. We could see her black hair and a white background, but her face was complete static, completely unrecognizable. Jim and I were overjoyed at what we saw because we knew so many reasons why you might not see anything at all. Well, Joy had followed us in. She looked at the picture and she said, "Needs work." We rewired it. It was easier to rewire it than to reprogram it, believe me. And up popped the first picture ever taken. Oh, it works. We filed for a patent, and the first patent for a digital camera was granted in 1978. U.S. Patent 5016107. We started to show it to people at Kodak, and then it became more interesting. I thought they'd spend all their time asking me, how did I get this to work? They didn't ask me any of the hows, they asked me why. Why would anybody want to do this? Very few people ever managed to successfully commercialize photographic film. Very difficult stuff to make. And once you've made that investment, the profit was considerable. So they ask you, show me the money, right? Yeah, it was a pretty hard sell. I wrote a technical report largely describing the technology that went into it and how it worked. But because of all of the challenges I got for the many meetings throughout 1976, I did write a paragraph in there about where I think this is going to go. It's called The Camera of the Future. The camera described in this report represents a first attempt at demonstrating a photographic system which may, with improvements in technology, substantially impact the way pictures will be taken in the future. The picture, existing in electronic form, could be sent over conventional communication channels with little or no modification. I was not allowed to say anything publicly about any of this work for 25 years. I kept the camera, and as I moved from office to office throughout my career, sometimes I'd forget it, and so I put, "Please return to Steve Sasson" on a poster on the back of it. Now the camera's in the Smithsonian. If you look on the back, you'll see that little sticker.
Kodak was reportedly so worried digital technology would destroy its film business, it sat on Sasson's invention. And that delay ultimately played a role in the end of the company. Sasson never got rich off his work, but he didn't go unrecognized. He was awarded the National Medal of Science, Technology, and Innovation by President Obama. This final note before we go today, an Italian fashion company that calls itself Steve Jobs after the Apple co-founder gets to keep its name and its logo, which is the letter J with a bite out of it and a leaf on the top. According to The Verge, the founders noticed back in 2012 that Apple hadn't trademarked Steve Jobs' name, and they decided to use it. Apple sued over both the name and the logo and lost. The brothers who run the company now say they're considering, for real, expanding the Steve Jobs brand into electronics. Today, the Dow rose 63 points, 0.25%. The Nasdaq gained 10 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 was up 4 points, 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.